The date is the 23rd of August 1997, and I'm conducting a guided walk around Pukekura Park with Friends of the Park. We're just set to go now, and there's a lot of back chatter because we had a little bit of fun getting the equipment together. We are now ready, yes, and we're all wired up, ready to go. I just suddenly realised I'm listening to what I'm recording, which is very, very confusing. Yeah. Okay, well, this is the second walk, as I had mentioned earlier, on this trip. And it is our intention this time to look at the central part of the park. We're now gathered in the entrance to the fountain lake between the car park, the main car park at the sports ground at Pukekura Park, and we're just in front of the plaque, which indicates that the fountain situated in the centre of the lake was commissioned in 1955, I think it was, commemorating the... 54. It was a Queen's visit in 1953-54 that the fountain commemorates. And many of you were here last time we did a walk, and we went on a little bit of this track, and I mentioned that where the fountain now stands, way back in towards the early part of the century, there was an island there, and W.W. Smith, the superintendent of the day, raised kiwis on that island. Those were the first kiwis raised in captivity. Now we're going to walk around towards the southern end of the lake, past the, well, not quite past, but towards the pump house, the fountain pump house. We're now approaching the outflow from the main lake as it enters the fountain lake. And we have to realise that this is totally artificial. The water flow that came down this valley originally did not discharge through here at all. This is a water race that was made to accommodate the water flow when they put the dam into the main, to make the main lake. And we may have an opportunity to see it later, but further up towards the office, there is a tunnel through which one can actually walk. And it wasn't until I'd been here as a curator for quite some years that I realised kids were getting into the sports ground free by walking down that tunnel. So it has all sorts of uses. And there are glowworms in it too. I don't actually want to take you as far as the pump house because we're making for Cannon Hill above us here. And I want to take you up this little route here because to me it's got a feature of its own. We're standing underneath the very, very large pine, which is Pinus toriana, from, where does it come from? San Diego, I think, in California, where it grows up to about 15 metres. These trees are over 40 metres tall, and the one down in the children's playground that we looked at last time is regarded as biggest in New Zealand anyway, and could be the biggest in the world, because as we know, many members of the pine family, particularly from dry areas, seem to respond out of all character when they're grown in New Zealand. Now, we're going up towards Cannon Hill on this rather unused route, and I want to take you up there because have a look at the steps. The steps really are just pine root steps. And the reason for that is that many years ago when they formed the path, they would have had conventional timbered steps there. And the tree roots have filled in the steps, the timbered steps, or the part that's retained by the timber. They are so dense under this very, very large tree that they completely fall all that structure, and the wooden fronts have just fallen away and We don't really need them anymore because, it's rather a wonderful thing. I think if you had that in Japan, though, it would be a tourist attraction. And people skip past it here and don't even look at it twice. But it's quite, I don't know of another one quite as good as this anywhere. It has the appearance of rocks, yes, that's quite right. They're all gnarled, and that's because the constant use by people, it's worn them, and the tree is always trying to repair that. We've got the two, just stop a minute, look in the tree here, the camellia tree. Just come up gently, if you don't make a lot of noise, he'll stay there. We're just within about 5 metres of a tui, and we're just within about 5 or 6 metres of a tui here, and he's in that tree because it's a camellia, and it's a single camellia. The single camellias, as distinct from the double ones, produce nectar. They flower in the winter, and the tuis know all about that, and go around these trees several times a day, taking the nectar from them. Yes, there's a whole, here we're looking at the pavilion, that's the back of the pavilion there, and around in this area there are quite a number of these these single camellias. Okay, if we just move on up the hill a little bit, we're getting closer to Cannon Hill now. Now we're under one of the big redwoods, and the tui's going along with us. You see, he's in that one there now. And there's possibly others around that we may see. I wanted to take you along here a little bit. We're now virtually above the fountain pump house. This track goes right round the right round Cannon Hill. You can walk around Cannon Hill on this track at the level of the bandstand. Bandstand's just around that corner. But I wanted to bring you here to show you the rubbish tip.
Oh, gee.
In a big garden such as Pukekura Park, there has to be, of course, a means of disposal of rubbish. And when trees either are pruned, or are damaged by storms or whatever, or die or whatever. There's Tui. He's keeping a close check on us, isn't he? I've got a feeling he might be thinking we're going to do something mischievous to his camellia trees.
Oh.
So he's watching us. They are very, very territorial, Tui's, and they guard their areas very, very judiciously. Anyway, you'll see we're standing in front of a big junk heap here, a big rubbish pile rather, not a junk heap, a rubbish pile. And this is, at this time of the year, could be an accumulation of a few weeks of work around the park. You'll notice there are a lot of tree fern fronds. New Zealanders overlook the significance of the tree ferns, of course, but visitors from overseas just go away, can't forget the wonderful tree ferns they've seen, because you don't get them in every part of the world, and certainly you don't get them in the northern hemisphere. Look at that fantail standing doing all sorts of tricks over there. See, it's rather wonderful, isn't it? We're in the centre of a city, and already we've seen tuis bouncing around, just singing away just in front of our faces virtually, and there's fantails flitting about. Anyway, the tree fern is very, very important to Pukekura Park, because you'll notice that every landscape, and in particular the waterscapes, they're a dominant feature around the edges. And they do actually come up very readily here, but in certain places where they don't, the staff have to make sure that there's a constant succession of tree ferns coming on to retain that character. And that's something that people, you know, newcomers could quite easily forget in terms of maintenance. You'll notice that the fronds are cut off, some of them quite green, and it's a two-sided thing, a tree fern. It's magnificent when, you know, in its plumed foliage, But that foliage comes down and it's very, very heavy, especially when it's young. And those things are very, very heavy indeed. And if there is any vegetation underneath, it suffers accordingly. And they are bad news if you have them growing over a shrubbery, like, for example, azaleas down there, where there are any pungas. This is the big one, the black mamaku. Where there are any of those over the top, you know, there's constant shedding of these fronds. Let's talk about Robert Clinton Hughes. Now, Robert Clinton Hughes, as we've already pointed out, was really the founder and father of the park, because it was he who got a group of friends together, and they put in some money and had this valley, this treeless valley, set aside as a reserve, and from that point on started planting trees. He served the park for 60 years, practically. He died in 1934, and just before he died, it's recorded that he planted a kauri tree. And of all the important trees that there should be in this place, we don't know which kauri tree it was, except that it was again planted, as indeed the original trees were, somewhere around this Cannon Hill. Now, there's a kauri here beside us, which could qualify in 1934. There's another one there, and that's about the same age. And I think on the other side there are one or two down on that side too. But we don't know which one Robert Clinton Hughes planted, because a kauri, where the pines have done their, 150 years nearly, they probably last 150. There's one died over the back there. These ones won't really last many more years. But the kauris would be there for hundreds, maybe 1,000 years. And one would like to think that we could associate a tree with that wonderful man. Now, I'll tell you a funny story here. We know that nowadays that big pine tree there, which is, we're looking back towards the hatchery lawn now, dominates over the hatchery lawn. That is said to be the Carrington pine. But I have a photograph which was taken, I think it was back in the 1920s, it might have been the 30s, and there is a pine tree with a white plaque on it, and it says this is the kauri that was planted by Jane Carrington on the 29th of May 1876 to commemorate the setting, you know, the establishment of the park. And it's not, I'm afraid, that pine tree that we see over the hatchery lawn, because in the background of the photograph is the sports ground, which means that we have to turn around 180 degrees and look that way. And as we go up, well, I think we pass the stump. I can show you the stump. The stump is still there of the pine that was photographed at that time as the Carrington pine. There's quite a lot of material trees taken off this hill in the 1950s. And I'm not accusing John Goodwin of having cut down the Carrington pine and switched the reputation to another tree. I think it's quite likely that early sign deteriorated and they didn't replace it. And because this pine over the hatchery lawn is probably much larger than the other one, somebody thought, oh, well, I'm always intrigued by that factor. I think I mentioned to you last time that Victoria Road and Carrington Road swapped names at some stage, and I don't know why that happened, and I'm not sure when it happened, but certainly the early maps show that what is now Victoria Road was Carrington Road and vice versa. So maybe it was a seniority thing, I don't know. Funny things happen in history, don't they? Okay, well, as you'll see, you cannot now see Cannon Hill from any distance because it's just surrounded in trees. But if you can imagine no trees here at all, not a single one, that is the picture of 1876. And so you can understand that the hill was the hub of all the activities of Pukekura Park. On the southern side of it, the lake was formed. On the northern side of it, that's the main lake. On the northern side of it, the Fountain Lake was formed, and on the eastern side of it, the sports ground was formed. And they were all very visible from that hill. And then, of course, the subsequent developments on this, what would it be, the southeastern side, the tea house, the drinking fountain, bandstand, and so on. So everything happened around here, around this hill. And notably also on that day in 1875, there were about five. Scanlon records the trees that were planted. Needless to say, we know that the pines, a pine at least, was planted. And that commemorated the American continent. There was a Norfolk pine planted down there at the southern end of the Fountain Lake, just where we now call it the Hatchery Lawn. There was a Norfolk pine planted there to represent the Pacific. There was a yew tree planted somewhere down here, and there is one down there. You'd never believe it was 150 years old, but there is a yew tree just near where the Fountain Pump House is now. That was to commemorate Europe, or to recognise Europe. There was a puriri planted, and we're not quite sure which one. That was to represent New Zealand. I was responsible for taking a big puriri up just down below us here, between the fire dump and the Fountain Lake, some years ago, but it wasn't a very big one. I'd like to think that it wasn't. I think I prefer to say that it was that one we were passed under when we moved from the sports ground car park into the Fountain Lake area. You go under that very big puriri. I was pointing out the flowers, and the fruits are still on it now. That too is not going to be very far away from us, is it? It's just flown across there. And there was another tree, an oak. An oak was planted to commemorate Europe. And those were the links. They did it with trees. And they were all planted around this Cannon Hill, as it subsequently became known. I'll tell you when we get to the top, it's more relevant. Remind me when we get to the top about the cannons. Anyway, that's the lower part of the park. The oak we're not sure of either, so you see... If you ever have a tree planted for you, make sure that everybody knows exactly where it is. It might be vandalised in your absence. All done with good intentions. Now, you'll see that a lot of the trees here are dominant, you know, very tall trees. And, of course, that was one of the important things of the plantings of the 1870s. They put in on these... practically every hill, and you'll see that, you know, we've got hills all around us, they put in pine trees. And the pine trees in 20 years were big trees, you know, growing faster than anybody ever imagined, I suppose, and to the point where they became very dominant. And you look up at the Carrington pine there and the other ones, and you see what straggly branches they have. And after about 50 years, pines develop a very heavy resin content in the timber, which makes it very, very brittle. And the consequence of that is that with the heating and cooling, the resins expand and contract, and they're not very flexible. And big branches can fall off on quite still days, on warm still days, because of that. The resins just swell and have no plasticity, and bang, and down they come. So they're quite dangerous trees from a public point of view, and I certainly wouldn't recommend anybody to go walking around on a very windy day under pine trees. The trees that are now starting to dominate are longer duration trees and much slower growing. We're standing under some... in the middle there's a redwood. But there's also there the Japanese cedar, and these are we're right under now the Californian redwood, this big one it's on the northern sort of tip of this level of Cannon Hill. Quite a wonderful tree, and This tree has the name Sequoia sempervirens. And come up and feel it. You're used to feeling pine bark, but come and feel this one. It looks rather like a pine's split trunk, doesn't it? But feel the bark.
Oh, yes.
It's quite different, isn't it? It's like, would you say it was like insel fluff? Because I mention that factor for a very special reason. This tree is almost indestructible as far as fire is concerned. The bark has already here, you can see, about 100 millimetres, 4 inches thick. And if we lit a fire here, you could burn all the branches off this tree, but you wouldn't actually damage the critical bark, the critical part of the plant, the tree where growth takes place, the cambium layers under the bark. They're protected from heat by this insulation. And it's called Sequoia sempervirens. Sempervirens meaning living forever and ever. And so it has that protection, the insulation protection from fire. But if a storm should come and break it off at a foot from the from ground level, unlike a pine tree, it'll send up a whole mass of new shoots and will become a tree again. So that's pretty unique in trees of that size and type. And so, you know, it does live forever and ever. Now, can anybody identify this firewood underneath the tree? My goodness, that's precious. You don't see that? That's rhododendron.
Mm.
Yep, no, it's rhododendron. And I don't know whether I can pull this one off here. There's a quality about rhododendron wood which I've not actually come across in many other woods. Those of you who are musically inclined, listen to this. I don't know whether I'll be able to do it. It has a remarkable ring to it. And I don't know any other woods that, you know, sort of round about.
Yeah.
George Forby, yeah. Yeah. Don't say anything else. You said the right thing. No, I'm a bit surprised. This is a branch that's broken, you see, off a... this is rhododendron Sir Robert Peel, the same as that one down on the lake there. And they're all over the park, but the bottom of it's gone rotten, so the whole branch is probably broken out. And they cut it up for firewood, but that's absolutely precious for a wood turner. Where would you get rhododendron wood? And Pukeedy, if you turn egg cups and vases out of that and took them up to Pukeedy, you could sell them like anything. Because it's very, very rare to have rhododendron wood. Sorry? Yes, I'm coming back with a trailer later. You didn't hear what I said. No, but it's too good. It's too good. I'm very sorry that it's chopped up for firewood, but a wood turner could still do something with that. Yeah. Okay, well, we haven't got very far, have we? You'll notice here that there are several trees going up. The Macrocarpa there is a pretty old resident, but not one of the original residents. This will be a stump. We're looking up towards the crown of the hill from the pavilion side now, and that will be a stump from one of the original pines. And that one just to the left there, out of which the Pūtakawa seedling is growing, I think that is the one that had the sign, the Carrington pine, in the 1920s or 30s. Now we're going around overlooking the sports ground now. This would have been the Scotsman's grandstand for the sports ground in years gone by. And you'll notice that we're still under camellia trees, single camellia. So you'll see the tuis have quite a good food source here. Come round to the eastern side of the Cannon Hill on this lower level, and the tree we're looking up at now, and we're sort of between the park office and Cannon Hill, that's a Kanikaha, the New Zealand celery pine. It's quite a good specimen, the Tanikaha. We don't see big ones so very often. I don't think there's a bigger one in the park. Well, it's pretty hard to say. Probably would have been planted, I think, in the 1880s. Most of the planted trees of any size here, and you have to be careful about size because some trees, of course, grow much faster than others, but the natives will grow much slower than the pines. But most of the trees were planted probably in the 1880s or late 1870s. And I think that would come into that category. Although it's surprising, some of the remus in good conditions, and certainly the cowries, grow remarkably fast. But we've come now to the path between the sports ground and the fountain on what I suppose is the eastern side of the Cannon Hill. And we're back on the main route from the sports ground to the fountain. Sorry, not the fountain, the drinking fountain and bandstand. That camellia just on the other side there, that's Donation, I think, Camellia Donation, which when it came out was all the rage. And I was responsible for putting in the first one there and it got stolen. I put in the second one and it got stolen because they flower very small. And then the third one, I thought nobody's going to get this one. And I put a whole lot of wire mesh underneath it, a big square meter or something of wire mesh, and put it around the plant. And nobody tried to steal it, so there it is. Now, we're at an intersection here. Again, another cowrie, but I think this is probably somewhat later than the others. I'm not sure about that. But we're now going to go up to the top of Cannon Hill on the staircase that sort of goes around. And we still overlook the sports ground. You'll see there's a planting of Tanikahas here, all of the same species. And there are actually quite a number of seedlings of Tanikaha coming up here. Yes, well, we're now sort of halfway up or three-quarter way up to the height of the hill, and we're looking back across the sports ground. And you can imagine what a dominant place this would have been in those days. We're looking through trees, but you would have looked right out there and seen the sea beyond. We're standing now beneath a young Norfolk pine, and that is the tree that was planted by Denny Sutherland as mayor when the centennial ceremony was held in Pukekura Park, commemorating 100 years of park. There's a funny story about that tree too. We wanted these. This is a rather an impoverished piece of soil, this mound, because, you know, leaching and all that takes the nutrients out of it very quickly. And I knew that we, planting these ceremonial trees, we wanted them to survive and thrive, in fact. And so I arranged for loads of good, rich soil. We dug great big cavities out, several square metres, took all the material out and arranged to bring some soil up. But you can understand, you can't get a tractor up here. And so we had to use a little piece of equipment called a gravely. It's often used for mowing rough areas in the park. It's a one-man thing driven by handles. You has two handles, like a conventional mower, I suppose, in a way. But this thing had, it was a fairly powerful engine, and it had a facility where you could tow a little truck thing behind, a little trailer. And the guy actually used to sit on the trailer with these two handlebars. Handlebars is the word I was trying to think of. And steer this thing up this the tracks that we've walked up and up to the various planting sites. I think there were four up on here. Well, he came up with a load and was going down. Now, he was sitting on this little trailer thing going down the hill, and he had a pair of khaki shorts on. And as he went off down the hill, it sort of got a little bit of speed up, and the coupling bounced off. And remember, he's steering this thing with the two handles, which is attached to the engine part of it, and he's sitting on the trailer. Suddenly the engine part's going a lot faster than the trailer, because when it dropped off, the thing dug into the ground, and he was sort of pulled forward. Well, unfortunately, the thing he was sitting on must have had some sort of a obstruction on it, and it caught in the leg of his shorts and ripped the middle out of his shorts between the leg, the crutch out of his shorts. And he had to chase after this machine, of course. He's suddenly, from a guy working in khaki shorts, he was tearing down the hill in a khaki skirt. That's the amusement of everybody saw it. Oh, dear old Ivan Jordan. We're getting close to the end of this tape. I'll just point out to you, we are now standing beside the Carrington. Now standing on the top of Cannon Hill, looking to that cold place. Oh, there's snow on the Purkeyes today, isn't there? You notice that? Right on the western end of the Purkeyes, loaded with snow. And so the southeasterly wind is coming in from a very cold quarter. And we're looking up the lake to the Poets Bridge, and the mountain is somewhere up behind the clouds in the background there.
Yeah.
The bandstand in the foreground. I don't think we'll stand here very long, but you need really to come up here to appreciate the wonder of these vistas. And vistas are so important in landscaping. It's all very well to have a great collection of trees, but if you can't stand back and look at them, some of their value is lost. And so this is a wonderful view. Many people will be familiar with the reciprocal view back from the bridge, back from the Parts Bridge towards the bandstand, but this is a lovely one, and you can sort of sit up here and watch the world go by and yet not be too much of a part of it. Now, it's appropriate to tell you about the Cannon Hill. You'll understand in the land wars of the 1860s, when all the residents, non-Maori residents, that is to say, and some Maori residents too, had to retreat to the protection of the town. There was a fort over beyond the kiosk there, up near where the band room now is. There was a fort established up there, which looked after this sort of side of the valley. And remember, in those days, there was no lake out there. It was just a little stream that meandered down past the hatchery. And then if we look over to the west, to the Victoria Road side, 25 Victoria Road, there was another fort there. So this was a sort of a no man's land overlooked by two forts. So the cannon were not here. There was no cannon mounted here during the land wars. That came later when the park was established as a park, and there must have been a few cannon lying around that were no longer of any consequence. And included amongst those was, I understand, Dickie Barrett's cannon from Namutu. That there are photographs of that located beside the kiosk, the tea house, later on. But what they did was, they mounted the cannon on this hill, Cannon Hill, just to display them. And here is one of the mounts, this concrete plinth here that I'm standing on. You'll see there's a piece of steel in the middle of it there. And I think at one time There were four. I was just looking around there. They've obviously widened that path, and this is how history can quickly disappear. It may well be that the people who did that development knew nothing about the significance of those flat, uninteresting-looking pieces of concrete. But there were, as I recall, four of them. There were certainly three looking in different directions. Oh, yes, immediately I came up here, I was looking for that. There was certainly one there, and I'm pretty sure there's another one there. So it looks as if they might have gone by the board. Sorry? Yeah, that's right. Well, they might have done it quite innocently, but that is what worries me, you see, this lack of continuity of staffing.
Is still in existence, George?
Well, certainly Dickie Barrett's cannon is. That's in the museum, isn't it? The main one. That was the historical one. I'm not sure about the others.
Hasn't had great fun getting them up here.
The cannon? Well, they were mobile, you know, they had little trolley wheel sort of things on them.
And the round ball shot.
Muzzle loading. No, muzzle loading, firing cannon balls, really early stuff.
There might be a few cannonballs lying around.
Well, as I say, there was none ever fired in anger here. They were not part of the land wars at all, which is easy to assume. There's a kauri tree planted there on the western side of the hill. That was planted by either Alex Brody or Don Saxton. I can't remember who now. But that was another ceremonial tree up here. And then we've already seen the Norfolk pine planted by Denny Sutherland. I think you can see have a look at the top of the bandstand with its striped red and white striped roof. I'll tell you a little bit more about that when we get down here. I think we'll get out of this wind now. It's quite cooling. Well, we've now come down off the Cannon Hill, and we're just on the lower slopes of it in front of the bandstand, which is behind us because we're looking back up at the hill. And this little plateau here that we're standing on is of some consequence for a number of reasons. At some stage, a whale was stranded on the coast here, and when its body deteriorated, they brought the whole skeleton up onto this Cannon Hill. And many of the old photographs you see of the park, the postcards and that, showing Cannon Hill, because of course it was always a pretty dominant part in those days, you'll see these big vertebrae of a whale, just like seats all over this southern side of the hill. And they took the jawbones and made a big archway here. And you're standing right in front of it, and in fact, there are the last remnants of it there. It's still around after probably about 100 years. The vertebrae were taken off the hill, many years ago, I'm not sure when, and the last of them were just, they're still evident just under the near the key house there where the water leaves the park. But you'll see that interesting feature in some of the old postcards.
Is there any reason given for that being done, George?
Sorry?
Is there any reason ever given for that being done?
The putting here of the bones. Well, I suppose. No, they just wanted to show them off, I suppose, and where better place for a lot of people to see them than Pukekura Park. I don't think there would have been any other reason. Can you think of what was your question?
It seems a very strange thing to do.
strange to put whale bones in Pukekura Park. Yes. Well, that's the only thing I can think of. There doesn't seem to be any other logic to it. They were pretty impressive, you know. This archway was probably 4 meters tall.
Yeah.
Do any of you remember?
Yes, I can.
You can remember. Yeah. at a point when they were still quite evident, and this is going into my time here in the 60s, there was a suggestion that they should be preserved and perhaps even taken away from here and put in the museum or somewhere more logical. But they had deteriorated to such an extent that it just wasn't quite possible.
It strange. If it was a dinosaur bone or something, perhaps it would be quite logical. Whales, quite a long way from the
sea. Well, yeah, but, I mean, where else would you see a whale bone sort of thing? Yeah, come to Pukekura Park and see the whale bones, along with all the other things. Goodness me, look at these skateboards. It's a menace that I never lived with. You'll notice I said about the way they had to be very, very careful in any monies they spent in the early days of development, because they didn't have great deal of money. And when we came to restore the bandstand for its centennial, well, all through my time here we had to be patching up, but they wanted to do a really good patch-up job on the steps. You see the, what is it, 8 steps, is it, and around there. Now, you'll see how scattered it is over there. That shell of concrete is only just sort of this thick. It's about as minimal as it could be. It's virtually plastering over, well, only over stones, you know. It's so sparingly built in terms of the amount of concrete that's in it.
Can you tell us about this area in association with the early days of the
bowl? Yeah, that's one point. When in the 1950s, under John Goodwin's superintendency, that it was suggested by the public relations officer of the day that this place should have a sound shell. This area was actually proposed that it should be here, and it's greatly to John Goodwin's credit, of course, that he said, no, you'd never really, it's not practical, you know, it's not the sort of place to, you can't get enough people and that sort of thing, it wouldn't justify its existence, and he actually suggested that they use that part of Brooklands, which is now the bowl. So that was how the bowl, you know, was going to be here. They were going to do some more excavation here or something and make the sound shell. And then, of course, they could do something on a really big scale up there. It was a wonderful move. Yeah, he had great foresight, John Goodwin. He stopped certain things that people were doing like that because they were not practical, you know. But he wasn't negative. He suggested something better. That's the way it went. Looking back at the onto the bandstand, you'll notice that roof. When in was it 1988? They had its centennial. I just can't quite remember the date. I think it's 88. They wanted to restore it to exactly as it was when it was put up, and to our surprise, it had that candy stripe roof, which seems a bit frivolous, doesn't it, for the Victorian era? But that's exactly as it was. They stripped down all the paint right down to the first layers and restored it to the colours it was in 1888.
Is that right?
Mm.
So it's the same iron.
Sorry?
It's the same iron.
Yes, I don't think it's been replaced. I'm not sure about that. I might have been. I seem to have some recollection of repairs. It's had some interesting incidents. As you'll see, it is a very, very difficult structure to get onto, to climb onto. And I was absolutely astonished one day when I came down, and on the top was a toilet pan. On the top of that finial, what do they call it? Finial, is it? Finial? Oh, that wonderful wrought iron finial up there. It was a toilet pan. Now, how the hell anybody ever got up there with a toilet pan, I will never know. I mean, I couldn't climb onto that without a toilet pan. So I thought that was a really enterprising and a humorous thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't so difficult. You had ladders, but I don't know that the person who, you know, somebody found a toilet. It was a damaged toilet pan. They hadn't pinched it or anything. It was a reject toilet pan. They carried it into the park and got it up on there and did that with it. And I thought that was a real achievement. Other enterprising things I'm not so thrilled about, but it didn't do anybody any damage, it didn't cost anybody anything except we had to go up and pull it down. However, relatively recently somebody stole that, you see it's damaged. Somebody stole the darn thing. They got it back, stole the finial. They climbed up onto there and stole all that above the ball there, that wrought iron work. It's been all smashed around and it was stolen. I can't remember. It's only recent. This has only happened in the last couple of years that it disappeared. And it was away for a long, long time. Yeah.
Damaged in the process.
It looks like it, doesn't it? Yeah. I can remember one Christmas. By the time Christmas came along, I was pretty fed up with, Christmas spirit. All the joy and pleasures of Christmas, I just about whacked out. We had to get the park ready for a lot of important things over the holidays, and it was a very, very busy time always. And this Christmas Eve, we lived just up through the trees there at 25, you see, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, it was carols, carols, carols. There was somebody singing carols at the top of their voice, and it went on and on and on. And I couldn't, there was no chance of us sleeping, so there are. I'm not against anybody singing carols, but this was getting crazy. So, yeah, there is a time and place, and I was getting pretty worn out. Anyway, I came down, and here's a gentleman. You see the 8 pillars there. He was weaving his way in and out through those pillars, round and round he was going, singing carols at the top of his voice, stark naked. And he had a group of followers who were sitting over there on the side there. And I thought, oh, this is crazy. So I said to them, look, I got no hassle with the guy being naked. That's no problem. But I said, he's just disturbing us, you know. You'll have better take him away. And he was as drunk as anything. You know. And I said, look, you better take him away. Otherwise, I'm going to have to do something about it. So they took him out towards the main gate. And as they went out, I always, you know, watched people. In fact, this... I'll go back to that later. Right, so I went down, there's a little track through the water course down there towards the car park, and I watched them go, and as they got out towards the car park, they picked up the white barrier that prevented vehicles coming up this way and threw it in the lake. Now, this is Christmas Day, and I thought, now I'm going to have to get somebody in to get that out of the lake. We don't want that there all over Christmas. And so I phoned the police, and they caught up with the guy before he got to the main gate, or before he got into his car. And I said, look, I'm faced with a situation here where I'm going to have that thing floating around. This guy said, don't worry, sis, I'll go out and get it for you. So he's already under police charge, you see, and they are not going to let a drunken guy go out and swim out in the lake in the middle of the night to get it. A barrier out. So they said, no, 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 I'll go and get it, he said. No, no. And the policeman said, we'll come to an arrangement. If by 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, or 10 o'clock or whatever it was, that barrier's gone, we'll forget about it. But you are not to, you know, we're not going to let you swim out there. And he said to me, if that thing's in the lake tomorrow morning, let us know. There's the police and we'll charge you. Well, we all left with that. And about 5 o'clock in the morning, tap, tap, tap on my door. What the hell's this, you know, it's this Christmas morning. And tap, 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 and I went. And here's the guy, he says, the other point was that if I had to get somebody in to do that, that I had to charge 3 hours at treble time or something. It would have cost a lot of money. Anyway, he's at my door and he says, you don't need to worry. He says, you don't need to get your people in. I've done it myself, he said. Danny woken me up at 5 o'clock in the morning after having had me out at 2 o'clock in the morning. Bless him. I said Merry Christmas to you too, mate. So that's one of the funny things. I should, and I never was. You know, part of my appointment. Anyway, this little spot we're standing on here, this was the perfect place to check on anybody who might be getting up to mischief. You know, they used to sit around on the bandstand and do all sorts of, plan all sorts of mischief and that, and I would never know whether they're going to be mischievous or not. So I used to sneak up here. This vegetation in front of us was a fringe a little bit higher, and I could stand here and, you know, hear what they were saying, hear what they were planning. And I always found that if you watched people for 5 minutes or 10 minutes before they were going to get up to anything, and then, you know, you could hear them planning things, and then approach them, even if you didn't go right up to them. I did go up to a lot of people, I suppose, but anyway, if you could repeat something that somebody had said to somebody else 10 minutes earlier, they did that really threw them. They didn't know how much you knew about them. And it killed, you know, it just took all the glamour out of doing something mischievous. And so I suppose I could be accused of being an eavesdropper and so on, but it was really, I found it of great value and interest in protecting the place if I could do that. And it worked many times. Or sometimes if things were getting out of hand, just shine the torch on them from here, from a distance. And they only needed to know. See, people come up here in the middle of the night, they thought they're in the middle of the jungle, and they'd be 10 feet tall, and they'd get up all sorts of mischief. And you could see it happening. One person would throw a seat in, or tip a seat over, you know, and the next one would say, oh, well, I can do better than that. And he'd pick the next seat up and he'd chuck it in the lake. And then somebody starts smashing them up, you know, just like a... like a snowball, just escalated out of something quite innocent to start with. And it was because they thought they were in the wilderness, you know, and nobody knew what was going on. Had another
now
funny
you're
thing.
Not here to have all that screwed.
No, I don't know what happens now. Yeah, anyway, better get off this cold site. We'll go down, have a look at the little drinking fountain down here. Yes, well, we're now standing in front of the drinking fountain. In fact, it's not... it is gurgling a little bit. Well, there we go. Erected to commemorate the Diamond Jubilee of Her Majesty Queen Victoria, 1897, and we are 1997, so it's 100 years old this year. It's functioned as a drinking fountain all that time, and... I can tell you a story about this one too. When the lighting got established in the park, and we were always trying to dream up different ideas and new thoughts on it, we realised that these three lions and these parts are made of marble, which is translucent. And we thought, my goodness, it'd be wonderful to get in that and put a powerful light in there and have the thing glowing from the inside. So we took off the plaque. In fact, I don't know that that's the original. They might have updated that, I think. I think the original was it was marble and lead, inlaid with lead, like tombstones. Anyway, you just chip off this surround here and took the plaque out, because there's no other way of getting into it. But we found that it's all concrete at the back, so that idea fell by the wayside. But at the same time, we tried to improve the flow of the water, the drinking water, into these three little bowls here. And it's very, very difficult. The water comes in and is divided into three pipes, and it's controlled by one tap. And so if there's any slight different resistance in any one of them, it'll upset the balance of the flow through them, and it wasn't possible to get them all working at the same time, you know, all working at the same force at the same time. And of course, it's a great trick for kids to go and get handfuls of gravel and block them up. It's a continual problem to keep it going. And then you get dandles come along and take smacks at it with various things. These have been chipped off by people. And this one got smacked by a beer bottle. This one facing out towards the lake got hit on the nose with a beer bottle at one stage. Smashed pieces off there. And you see these rings here. At one time there used to be a cup hanging on those. So, you know, it was really put there for a function. And it's still, after 100 years, still capable of doing that function. But very, very difficult to... The flow of water, to control the flow of water between that little lip there and the bowl which receives it, is very, very difficult indeed. The town pressure can vary a little bit, and it goes
different.
No, the tap to control it inside. Oh, yes, there is a major tap outside, a controlling cock, but it is difficult to control. And it's only got to be going a little bit too much, and it splashes all over people, you know, it splashes down here. So it's a bit of a nightmare to keep it going. But it's great that it's a monument that's so old and it's still so functional.
Wonderful. What have they actually been
doing
to that recently that they've had it all roped off and everything?
Yeah, they've redone the... I think they might have water blasted or polished it up a bit. But again, you can see how crumbly all the material is. And they've replaced that plaque, Molly. Mm. It's had a big clean-up. Of course, it gets algae on it. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's New Zealand fern. Yeah, so it commemorates that we're looking at the four plinths on the around the top of it. There's the thistles, the thistles for Scotland, the fern for New Zealand, the rose for England, and the shamrock for Ireland. There we go.
What about Wales? Why did that get lifted?
Wales, there's no leaks there, is there?
No.
My goodness, I wish we hadn't noticed that. Oh, here's the leak here, look. It is, yeah. Mm. Oh, there was a lot of thought put into these things. Well, perhaps if we walk this way, we'll get out of the wind. And we're walking now towards the waterfall. Oh, there was something I wanted to you to experience here. We're now at the bandstand, and there's so much wind confusing us. But if you stand about exactly here, and it's very, very critical, and I'm now, for those who are not viewing this scene, I'm standing at the steps to the main lake here where the boats go, and the fountain's off to the left, the waterfall, sorry, is off to the left. The sound of the waterfall hitting those steps bounces off, and you hear it just in a very narrow band here. But there's too much wind for us. But if you come at night, sorry? Yeah. Mm. Yep. Yes, if you move around, see, if you come into this angle, it's bouncing off those steps straight back at you. If you go over there, it bounces off at the angle that it hits the steps, and you get it at a different point. But try it at night. It's quite strange when there's no other sounds around. And it's quite, I've passed here hundreds and hundreds of times, I suppose maybe thousands, and you know, you sort of pick up things like that. Now, with the bandstand behind us and looking at the waterfall, this is the dam that formed the lake. Originally, the little stream just flowed down through here and down through the hatchery lawn and on out as it does now. But they formed this dam, and they had to do it very, very carefully because there's quite a big volume of water here, and if it broached, it goes down the Huatoki stream and straight into the town, and they were worried they would create problems further down with flooding if the dam ever broke. So it was very, very carefully constructed with the right materials and to sort of engineering specifications. But that meant that this part, well, it sort of separated the park into two levels, if you like. This level here, and about 12 feet down, the level of the lower lake and the lower park, the kids' playground. And so that's what it is. It's totally artificial. I don't know whether they had to bring special materials into
this.
Well, only this part of Cannon Hill. They would have got something out of Cannon Hill, but probably not very much. It's hard to know what this area of the bandstand was like then, you know, whether there was a, you know, it might have come right out, the mound might have come right out to the steps, and they could have got a vast amount of material out of that.
But,
oh yeah, I think so, yeah. That would have been 1877, I suppose, 76, 77. They worked on that pretty quickly, you know, both the sports ground and this. The tree, green tree, that's the Tarata, or Pitosporum, the native.
It's the Tarata.
Yeah, the native Tarata, yeah. Well, yes, and there were two cabbage trees there, and those cabbage trees there are picturing, and they've only just recently, that one's only just recently been taken out, and they've planted one in its place. They feature on the very earliest photograph taken of the of this area. We'll just go quickly around here then. Well, we're now passing the entrance to the Smith Walk. Smith Walk is named after W.W. Smith, that superintendent who was in charge of the park from, I think, about 1908 to 1920. And it's said that he planted a lot of the native trees that feature in the northern end of the park or towards the children's playground. The Smith Walk starts here and sort of wanders around, goes around the eastern side of the Fountain Lake and out to the Gilbert Street entrance. It's a very, very He is the man who raised kiwis. He's a great, he was an internationally renowned ornithologist. And long after his death, apparently, there were still letters coming to this great bird expert.